You are listening to the one and only Visionaries Wrestling Network, envisioning excellence and providing your perfect podcast experience.
Hey guys, it's Chris, and welcome to another episode of Chris Talks Games. Thanks for tuning in again. Thanks for listening in again. It's been an interesting week in terms of gaming. Some things outside of the gaming world have been affecting the gaming industry, which is interesting to see. A few interesting stories coming out. And my main focus point for this episode will be game peripherals. I'm going to talk through some of things I thought were a bit kind of strange or eccentric kind of peripherals, and just like ones I liked, really, kind of like, wouldn't necessarily my favourites, but like things that have taken my interest with how they worked. So without much further ado, let's crack on with the news. Okay, so Nintendo actually had a Direct last week, which was the Direct for the Animal Crossing New Horizons, which is due out on the 20th of March, so that was cool, exciting. There's a lot of information crammed in. The game is looking lovely, looks really beautiful. A lot of different changes coming in. So it is looking like there was a few different changes. They still haven't really said much about what's happening with the game save situation, and the ability to transfer your save data. That's something that is becoming apparent. There's a bit of an afterthought for Nintendo at the moment, which is a bit of a shame. We'd like to have thought they'd have something in place for that, and they would have thought about that. But I think they didn't realise quite how much people would like to be able to take their save data across and transfer to different consoles, things like that. So that'd be interesting to see what they do with that. My full reaction to the Direct is on my YouTube channel, so if you found this through my Twitter, then just look back through my tweets and you'll be able to find the link to the YouTube video. If not, we'll be on Chris Reacts. Feel free to check my reactions to the Direct and also watch it, because there's a lot of information in there, good watch in my opinion, especially if you're interested in the game at all. Next up is going to talk a bit about next generation console pricing. Not sure if I covered this at all last time, I can't remember. There are a lot of rumours going around about the price points for the new PlayStation 5 and the Xbox Series X, and how much they're likely to cost each. As obviously with the new technology, is getting more expensive to make them, and with the advance in smartphones as well, a lot of the parts are actually getting a lot scarcer, a lot more in demand. So they are finding that more and more companies are after these parts. So the actual cost of a lot of the chips and like the memory chips and memory cards are actually going up quite a lot. I think one bit of news that has come out is that apparently the price to manufacture a PlayStation 5 is reportedly around $450, which means that the fact that we could be looking at $500 consoles is a real possibility. The Xbox Series X is in theory going to be even more. I think some of the working out of the parts and that people have done have kind of pointed out that it could potentially be a $600 system. It was really interesting. It kind of it's been said there's a big reason why they haven't announced much in regards to pricing for the consoles yet. Apparently, Sony are kind of waiting for Microsoft to make a move before they set their price. Microsoft will probably like to do a big blowout at E3 in June, where they'll do announce their release date and price. And if they are doing the much-rumoured cheaper version, which won't be as powerful. So if they do decide to do that, that could also end up affecting Sony's price point. If the Xbox Series X, like the main version, is about $600, I think Sony probably will opt for about $500. If Microsoft do try and go in cheaper, it'll be interesting to see how Sony respond to that, really. With both consoles throughout this year, I think they both want to be competitive. It'll be interesting to see how the prices work out for those. It doesn't look like it's going to be cheap. Not going to be a cheap console war, this one, I don't think. That's my thoughts on the prices. Microsoft did actually do a big info dump on their website with a lot of features being confirmed for the Xbox Series X. One thing that is kind of quite intriguing, I think Microsoft will be doing it for their first party games, but it'd be interesting to see if it's picked up by third parties or not, is the ability to with backwards compatibility, if you've got like a Xbox One game, for example, you play it on the Xbox Series X, if there's a Xbox Series X version of it, it will update it with the any changes, like any improvements in textures or any additional features that were in the Series X version. And they'll do that for free, so you wouldn't have to pay effectively for the same game to get the enhanced version or the special, like any enhancements that are on top of the base game that will be on the Xbox One. I can see Microsoft doing this a lot with all their in-house games. But I do worry whether third parties will take use of this. I know that CD Projekt Red have said that they will be doing it with Cyberpunk. So if you got Cyberpunk on the Xbox One, if you put it in your Xbox Series X, it will update free of charge with like the improved visuals, any changes that between the two versions, they'll be free of charge. CD Projekt Red did put in a tweet that no game should ever have to pay for the same game twice, which is a really good stance for them to take. But I do wonder whether other game companies will do that, the likes of Activision, Rockstar, because GTA 5 is still selling really well, and that has been released on both Xbox 360 and PS3 and re-released on PS4 and Xbox One. And they've been milking, I don't know if milking is the right word, but they've been pushing it. And a lot of people I know have bought multiple versions of GTA 5. So it's whether companies like Rockstar and Activision and places like that are willing to potentially lose that income. That will be interesting to see. Something I can't really see happening. It's like the same with like EA, places like that. Getting like a resale of games, getting people to buy the same game twice is an easy way to make money. It's a bit of a shame if it does happen, but I can see a lot of companies opting to still do the remasters and like re-release it and not do the free updates. Like I say, it would be a shame to see that, but I think that is the way it's going to go. The last bit of news I've got for now is how external fact like coronavirus and how it is affecting the gaming industry. Sony was all set to be at a couple of trade shows like PAX East and the Game Developer Conference, or GDC. They also had to go there, and literally like 10 days before PAX East is due to start, which is this weekend at the time of the podcast going out. Sony just pulled out, and they cited coronavirus and wanted to protect their employees as the sole reason for not attending PAX East. They were due to have quite a large stand there as well, so it is a big move from Sony. Bit of a surprise. Took a lot of a surprise. I think also it's made more people question whether Sony are willing to talk about the PlayStation 5 yet. So I think though, obviously when they would have been there, questions would have been asked about PlayStation 5. The Game Developers Conference, GDC, that is seeing even more companies pull out. Like, Sony again pulled out of it. Not at the same time as PAX East, but like about a week later, they announced it wouldn't be there. Well, last couple of days. And Facebook have also pulled out. It was quite a weird one, because the GDC is where a lot of companies meet and a lot of discussions take place. It's a lot of the Tokyo Game Show. There's a lot of behind closed door stuff where companies talk to each other and like ideas get green there, and like you might find projects end up being started there. So yeah, it's kind of a bit of a surprise, especially if PlayStation 5 throughout this year, whether Sony is seeing it out when there's a chance to push more PlayStation 5 stuff and get more companies involved, maybe. But yeah, no, Sony are sitting out GDC and PAX East this year. But Sony do seem to be not showing up as much. It seems like 2020, there doesn't seem to be much big gaming stuff. Like, by now, we would have normally had a general Nintendo Direct, which would be covering what's coming spring and summer. Still no sign of that. A lot of people are expecting one soon, because obviously after Animal Crossing comes out the 20th of March, we have no real confirmed release dates for any of Nintendo's upcoming stuff for the year. And after Xenoblade Chronicles Definitive Edition, there's not really much that we know is on the way from Nintendo this year. So the Nintendo are well overdue having a direct to announce some of their projects. A lot of people were expecting one to be before PAX East, and then maybe a lot of things are announced at the direct be at PAX East, but that's not the case. I think a majority of their stand will be Animal Crossing, which is understandable because it's a game, their next big release. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see when we actually do get direct and what they show off in it. But yeah, that's really about coronavirus really kind of impacting the gaming industry. Especially Sony, they're kind of really taking it quite seriously. And some people are speculating because they probably might have press things and press events. They don't want any of their top brass or key members of staff potentially getting ill. So maybe that's it. But yeah. That pretty much wraps up my news for this episode. So yeah, on to the main topic. Okay, so main topic this time is something a little bit different. It's looking at different peripherals, different controllers, different things you can use to play games that have come up across the years. Some weird and wacky and some that I just like and want to mention and highlight. I have to admit that one, I'm going to try and start further back in time and come more modern. So try and work my way up as we go. So one thing I don't really know what it did, I just know of it, purely because he's a character in Smash Brothers, and that is the Rob. It was to do with the NES. So I don't really know what he did. No, it's something to do with rings and like, there's a couple of games that he used him, but he was like a little robot that you could use with your NES. Which I've mentioned because it was pretty pretty unique and pretty random. I probably should have done a bit more research into what he was, but I think he's really cool, and I love how he is in Smash, and especially in Smash for Wii U, it was one of my go-to characters. I thought his controls were really cool. But yeah, I think controls in general were pretty basic at that point. The next real kind of massive innovation came in, like, in my eyes, from what I know of different controllers, came actually with the Sega Saturn, and Sega developed the analog pad for Knights. It's the first controller that actually had analogs, like analog control scheme, which is really cool. Never used one because they were really, really rare. Yeah, it's really cool. It was a big innovation. Then after that, Sony introduced the DualShock controllers. And then I think the good thing about the analog pad for the Saturn is, especially for Knights, the D-pad wasn't great. Yeah, because you had to be quite fluid with your movements and stuff like that, the D-pad wasn't the best way to control it. So yeah, it's really was quite a big innovation for the time. This controller is quite an iconic controller, but it's also kind of, how much it is kind of weird, is the N64 controller. It's almost like a three-pronged kind of like fork kind of thing, and it's just, first time I tried to use it, I was playing Mario Kart 64 with a friend. Hadn't used it before. I was trying to hold like a traditional controller, I had my hands around each kind of prong on the end, I was trying to reach the analog stick in the middle. It really wasn't working. So yeah, it's felt kind of weird, because you didn't really use the D-pad. So D-pad was on the left-hand side. You kind of held it in a really weird position, like your kind of left-handed grip around the middle prong, and you'd use your analog stick, and then you'd use your right hand for the A, B, and the four camera buttons, or like the four C buttons. So yeah, it was a really kind of bizarre control setup, which I thought was quite weird. I think it's, in terms of like the more traditional controls, probably the weirdest one has been. Really wasn't kind of that great. That was not my favourite controller to use. Even after I got used to holding the way you're supposed to hold it, it just really didn't feel as good as it could do. But yeah, it was a really weird controller. Next, I'm going to move on to another Sega console, which is the Dreamcast. Dreamcast controller itself wasn't massively revolutionary. Like, it had like the analog shoulder buttons, which is really cool. But where it got unique was its centerpiece, where you literally had like a little hole in the front of the controller, and you had like two slots that you could slot things into. And this is where the next proof I'm going to talk about came into use. It's like the VMUs, or visual memory units. It's basically the Dreamcast memory cards, but the way they worked was, it was a little kind of unit with a screen on, and you had like a little D-pad, a couple of buttons. It was really cool, because when you started it into the controller, the screen lined up with a hole in the front. A lot of developers could do it where they could get different things to come up on the screens, like, could be in-game stuff, could be maps, could be, it could be different maps, could be, just the game's logo come up. Some games did also do little features on it, like, Psycho Venture, you could download, or you could, send you a little KO from, or Cheo from the Cheo Garden, you could put it on the VMU, and you could take it on adventure. You could build up its skills, stuff like that. So yeah, the visual memory unit was pretty cool, pretty unique. I don't think it got used to its full potential, unfortunately, especially with the Dreamcast not taking off that well. I think the Dreamcast, I still think it's the most underrated console. But I think like the memory card is great, and they weren't that expensive from what I remember. The price wasn't too extortionate for what they were. Yeah, I think it was really cool having that kind of device for your memory card. It was something that's not really been done since. I think it worked really well. Adding new extra dimensions to a lot of the games. So other things it could be used for was great. The Dreamcast, like I say, is a bit of a underrated console in my eyes. There were also another couple of great peripherals in the Dreamcast. They had the fishing rod for Sega Bass Fishing. One of the first consoles to have that kind of peripheral, I think, from what I can remember. Never owned one, but it seemed to work really well from what people were saying. And the other one, which I was kind of gutted not to get, was Samba de Amigo on the Dreamcast. They did re-release Samba de Amigo on the Wii to make use of the Wii remotes, which I'll talk more about in a bit anyway. But Samba de Amigo, yeah, actually came with a pair of maracas. And the game cost like 100 quid. And because of where it came out in the console's lifespan, it was really rare and really hard to get hold of. So, again, not something I got to play with. But a lot of people did seem to like the... maracas. Next thing I'm going to talk about is the GameCube peripheral. Seems like it's switching between Sega and Nintendo quite a bit, but I'm going to be honest, for me, they've had like the most unique peripherals and things like that. Nothing really against Sony or Microsoft. They've not really done massive kind of like unique peripherals, really, the only thing that sticks out to me, really. The GameCube, we're going to talk about the bongo drums for Donkey Kong Jungle Beat and Donkey Konga. It's a great little peripheral. Donkey Kong Jungle Beat was really kind of quite unique. It's a platform that you used, that you played using these bongos, and how you tapped it and how you interacted with it kind of really kind of affected how your character moved. It's really kind of an interesting platformer to play. And Donkey Kong is a great rhythm game. Quite a few fun songs. It's really, really cool how the game worked like that. I really enjoyed the peripheral. They're quite sturdy. It was literally like two bongo drums and a little bit in the middle of a microphone on. So it's really kind of a bizarre kind of setup, but it's a lot of fun to use. I remember my mum, like, I was about 18, 20-ish when they came out. I had a load of friends over one night. I remember my mum walked in while I was playing Donkey Konga, and she made a dig at me, like, in front of my friends. Oh, you'd never think he was 18, would you? There's quite a bit of a few laughs at the time, but it's a lot of really fun peripheral. I only really used for a couple of games though, so it wasn't really used for much, unfortunately. But it's really kind of interesting peripheral to use. Next up, I am going to talk about Nintendo again and the Wii Remote. I remember the unveiling of the Wii. Was originally the code name was Revolution. Nintendo really held back on the controller. They didn't really show it off at all. Everyone knew it was just going to be a new innovative control scheme, and nobody really knew much about it. I knew the box, knew the name, they unveiled that kind of stuff before the controller. I was like, we're going to show the controller later today, we're going to show it later today. Then they finally did. I think it took a lot of people by surprise. A lot of people looked at it and thought, like, how is that a controller? And then they had, like, the nunchuck that they showed off as well. So, kind of, like, it's a really big, bold move away from what you expect a game controller to be. Obviously, you'd be using both hands. The nunchuck with a, like, analog stick and a couple of the shoulder buttons in one hand. You had the actual Wii remote with, like, the A, B buttons and, like, the 1, 2 buttons. And, like, your home menu and stuff like that on the other one, on the actual remote itself. I think when they first showed it off, a lot of people were like, what the hell is that kind of thing? It has been one of the biggest moves away from a traditional controller we've had in quite a long time, to be fair. I think they worked really well. And all of, like, the motion stuff, which really took a lot of people by surprise, because motion controls wasn't really something that had been done massively. I noticed how many Amigo used it to a certain extent with the maracas. It's really cool how it worked. I think it surprised a lot of people. One thing that surprised me a lot is how small they were. I thought they were going to be larger. I thought that the actual Wii remote would be a bit larger than it was. So when I actually got my Wii and saw it for the first time, I was quite surprised at the size of it. It actually did fit quite comfortably in your hand, so wasn't all bad. I think the Wii remote was a really kind of good controller, really. And I'm going to talk about, it's kind of still the Wii remote in some senses, but this peripheral, which incorporates the Wii remote, I did mention to Matt, it's like the most unique thing probably on this list. Although it does, like, the actual material does come up a bit later on, is actually a cardboard box. It sounds strange, but on the Wii there's a game called Let's Tap. You buy the deluxe edition that came with a couple of branded cardboard boxes. And the way it worked was basically you'd... Let's Tap was basically a few kind of different mini games. The way it worked would be you'd have the cardboard box in your lap, and you'd lay the Wii remote with the buttons facing down on top of it, and then you'd interact with the game by tapping the box. And the game reacted to the vibrations and how much the motions caused by tapping the cardboard box. It was a really bizarre concept. And I still get out a few times now, and people do play it, and they're kind of like, what the hell is this? It's a game that I do kind of think had a lot of potential, and it kind of showed off how much the Wii remote was quite sensitive to stuff like that, like movements and vibrations. But I think the best mode I played most on Let's Tap was like a race one, where depending how hard you tapped and how quickly you tapped the box, depending how fast you went, you had to hit it harder to jump and stuff like that. You had to really get the nuance with the cardboard box and like how hard you had to tap it and how you had to tap it. It's kind of weird to explain. We had to get the niche and the knack of, and like the rhythm of how to tap it, and you had to go through these race courses, just like a left to right, almost like a platformer stage. You had to race either the CPU or the other people you're playing with to try and get through it first, and try and complete the level first. It was Fairly bizarre game. But it was a fantastic use of the Wii Remote and a couple of boxes of peripheral, basically. Definitely worth looking at. The game is actually one of the first projects by Yuji Naka, who the creator of Sonic. It was one of the first things he did after he left Sega. Or left Sonic Team. He kind of set up his own development studio, and Let's Tap was one of their first games, like Probe Studios, I believe. We would have thought it, but Cardboard Box was one of the peripherals we're going to talk about this. That's probably one of the most unique peripherals I'm going to talk about. Okay, next up is still staying with the Wii, is the Wii Balance Board. Bit of a craze was Wii Fit. A lot of people seem to like it. It's quite a fitness craze at some one point in the Wii's life cycle. The Wii Balance Board was primarily used for the Wii Fit series. But it did also incorporate into a few other games, like you had I think it's Shaun White snowboarding you could use it for. So you could actually use the balance board for snowboarding. Also had is Mario and Sonic at the Winter Olympic Games you could use it for. To use it for some of the events on there. And another great thing that they used it for and worked quite well was there was a Super Monkey Ball. Super Monkey Ball actually used it as well. I'm trying to remember the name of the game actually. Super Monkey Ball Step and Roll, I believe, was the game. I used the balance board, so you'd stand on the balance board and lean to control the level, which was made it fairly tricky actually. It was a lot of fun, but also was fairly tricky because it all was controlled by your balance and your weight. So again, I think it's something that potentially could have been used a bit more, but I think it was used quite well when it was used. I know, sorry about that, Cody's found one of his toys. Sorry about that again. Cody, leave it alone. The balance board was a fairly clever thing, and it did capitalise on quite a big market. Like, got a lot of people involved in the Wii. Then the Wii itself and its control scheme did open up gaming to a wider range of people. I think some of these people also were kind of like mums and like a few older people as well. So I think the fact that they used Wii Fit to show off the balance board was a really clever move by them. It was a really interesting control scheme. Around the same era, you did also have a few other kind of peripherals come out. Throughout the PS2, PS3 era, you had the Guitar Hero guitars. Not gonna lie, I was god awful at Guitar Hero. It's not a game I'm good at. They did also have the DJ Hero, which I did like a lot more. DJ Hero I thought was really great. Loved having like the deck and the fader between the two songs, stuff like that. I think DJ Hero worked really well. I think the controller worked really well. Me personally, I got that a lot better than the guitar. The guitar just didn't really do very well with, so So yeah, Guitar Hero and DJ Hero were really good games in my opinion. I think the peripherals worked pretty well for what they needed to. I think they did die out a bit. But also around this time you had the dance mats. So like the big arcade dance machine games did come across the consoles. I think Konami did particularly well with that. It's a lot of fun. Also, PS2, PS3 era, you had Buzz, the quiz game thing, which was really interesting. And the controllers were kind of like a big red button. You had different kind of options beneath it as well for like doing your different answers. So yeah, Buzz was interesting. I think it worked pretty well as well. It's a shame they don't really seem to be going very much anymore, which is a bit of a shame. I think it was a really good kind of use of it. Next up, we're moving on to Microsoft a bit. They had their Kinect controller, or like the Kinect. So I thought it worked really well, actually. I know a lot of people weren't a fan of it, but me personally, I quite liked it. All the games are pretty cool. I think they work pretty well. Especially like the Kinect Sports. I really like that. And Dance Central. I'm a massive fan of Dance Central. I actually remember putting on Facebook how much I liked it, because I think I just played it for an afternoon and I was drenched with sweat after about a half hour to an hour. I guess summertime I was playing it, but also it was kind of was just a lot of fun. I think Kinect actually picked up the movements pretty well. So I think it's a bit of a shame that Kinect didn't, for want of a better word, didn't connect as well as a lot of people wanted it to. I understand people were concerned about the privacy thing, where it was kind of always on kind of thing. I think Microsoft kind of shot themselves in the foot a bit like that. But anyway, really, it's not much difference to Alexa and stuff like that. The only issue is the fact that it is a camera. But not sure where the camera bit stayed on, but I know the microphone did the whole time. But yeah, it's kind of intriguing how that stuff and that is kind of taking off now, whereas Kinect kind of rolled a lot of people out the wrong way. But yeah, I really enjoyed the Kinect. I think it worked pretty well for what we needed it to. Like I say, Dance Central I do really enjoy. I thought it was a great use of it. And I know on the Xbox One I had a Fantasia game, like a Disney Music one. A lot of Disney music, also like some licensed music tracks as well. We had to kind of like compose music, stuff like that, which I thought worked really well. Yeah, so that's like Kinect. It's kind of like Xbox 360 and Xbox One kind of area. Okay, next up, I'm going to talk about a controller that was very polarizing. Some people don't like it at all. Well, I actually quite like it. Although it has some really great uses, and that is the Wii U gamepad. Yeah, a lot of people don't like the Wii U gamepad, whereas I find it pretty awesome. What I liked about the Wii U gamepad is it allowed a lot of different gameplay mechanics. Like Wonderful 101 is being remastered and re-released in April by Platinum Games, but that was a Wii U game originally. What I liked about that is you could do a lot of it. It was like drawing patterns to make formations for your teams and like make them into different kind of like you could do a straight line to turn into a sword, you could turn them into like a right angle to turn them into a gun, stuff like that. Turn them into a circle, I think, to make it a shield. It's been a while since I played it, but I can't remember, but you could draw those on the pad. And also with Wonderful 101, if you went inside houses, the inside the house would come up on the gamepad rather than the screen. which I thought was really cool. A lot of multiplayer games, like you'd be in a fifth screen, maybe. Like, I remember Tycoon All-Star Racing transformed. Like, you could have five players, one person have the gamepad, and the other four would be on the main screen. I thought that worked really well. So that was like five-player multiplayer locally. Nintendo Land worked really well with it. A load of different mini-games showing off the gamepad. Where you'd have like some things going on in the main screen, and a lot of stuff going on just the gamepad screen. So for example, the Mario 1, you'd have four players on the main screen. You're going to see like their own kind of view of the thing, whereas with the gamepad, the person who's playing Mario and trying to run away, you could literally kind of, you could see the map of where the other people were in your own kind of, your own little view. So you had to try and use the map to scale away from the four people who were hunting you down, which is really cool. There's an amazing Luigi's Mansion minigame where the person on the gamepad controlled the ghost. And you're invisible to the other four players who are using the TV screen. So you had to try and sneak up on the four other players to try and sneak up on them to make them pass out. Whereas they had torches and had to try and catch you basically with their torchlight. And whenever you got close to them, like the people who had the normal Wii remotes, their controllers would vibrate when you got close to them. And then when you got close to them, it would be, they'd vibrate more and more. And that's when they knew you were close to them. I think the Wii gamepad was really underestimated quite a bit, personally. I know it's kind of like a precursor to what the Switch should have been, or what the Switch is kind of thing. So I think if Nintendo had waited a few more years and done the Switch instead of the Wii U, I don't know if it worked quite as well, but like I said, I did really enjoy the Wii gamepad as a controller, so yeah, it's a bit of a shame they didn't really kind of, the concept didn't really take off or land as well as it should have done. But yeah, and then move on to a bit more modern day stuff. And Microsoft have got their Xbox One accessible controller. It's not something, again, it's not something I've had a chance to go hands on with. I know Alex from Game Junkies has had a kind of experience with a kind of accessible controller. I'm not sure whether it's the Xbox One or not. But the great thing about the Xbox One accessible controller is made gaming accessible to a lot of people with like disabilities, really. So like maybe they're like missing fingers or arm amputation, stuff like that. I've not games to people so they could actually play games, and it's really commendable what they did with it, actually. It's great to see. I think it's their 2018 E3 conference, sorry. Yeah, the 2018 E3 conference. They actually had someone using it to demonstrate one of the games. I think it's Forza Horizon 4. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that they had someone on the stage actually using the accessible controller to use it. Yeah, it was really cool. I think it went really well. I think it's something I'd like to see more companies do. That's another thing about the Wii Remote going back, is a bit more accessible to people. So a lot of the games didn't require both hands or stuff like that. Like, a lot of people found that could find a way around it to play some games with just the Wii Remote. It was really good. It opened up games to a lot of people, which is really cool. Moving on to Switch. Not necessarily going to talk about the Joy-Con, because although they have got fairly unique features, and like they have got the HD Rumble, which if you want to see the HD Rumble in full effect, you really need to play 1-2 Switch. And that is the, well, the best kind of showcases for me in terms of what the HD Rumble can do. Especially the mini, especially the game where you have to try and guess how many balls are in the box. It sounds really bizarre, but you do it by tilting the Joy-Con in your hand. And no word of a lie, it feels like you've got balls running around inside the Joy-Con controller. It is an insane sensation to feel. And it just really shows off what the Joy-Con is really capable of. But yeah, so I'm not really going to focus on the Joy-Con because they are kind of pretty standard controllers, with the exception of like the HD Rumble and the IR camera in the right Joy-Con, I think, does especially come up quite useful in what I'm about to mention, which is, again, back to cardboard and Nintendo Labo, really. Nintendo Labo is a kind of bizarre concept. You try and describe it to people and think, oh, it's just cardboard. But I think it does actually work pretty well for what it is. Especially a lot of this, like the original stuff. Like the robot's great. You can stomp around big cities and it works pretty well. And like, even just like the original variety pack where you had the motorbike, like the fishing rod, the house, the piano. Those really do work pretty well. Remember when the first trailer for it came out, everyone was like, what the hell is this? But it's Nintendo completely changing the game and showing off the capabilities of the Joy-Con. Because the white Joy-Con does have like a little IR sensor in the bottom of it. The way the Labo works is you have like reflective stickers and a lot of bits. And the IR camera picks up what it's in, what kind of stuff's been inserted into it, and like the different stickers and stuff like that, and it reacts to that. Yeah, it is kind of really kind of quite bizarre to use, but it is also quite satisfying. I haven't made everything. I have made a fair few things. I've made like the fishing rod, I made the motorbike, I've made I've made a couple other bits, but the fishing game is actually really, really quite good, I think. And it's just like, I think Labo did get a bit overlooked, I think. I know I did show, try not to sound biased because I did end up showing it off at the 2018 EGX in Birmingham. So the part of the Nintendo Stand I was on that year was Labo. So showing off the robot kit, the variety kit, and also like the vehicle kit, which is just coming out at that point. I think my main takeaway from the experience at EGX is just how durable it is. Like, I think I was just cardboard, but considering the battering and how much it got used, we didn't have to replace that many parts, to be fair. It did really kind of, it surprised a lot of people at the Expo, actually. A lot of people came up and weren't, I think they were a bit more intrigued because it was a bit of a quieter game. People just popped in without like a few spare minutes. But I think they had actually really kind of surprised people what you could actually do with it. So like the fishing game and the motorbike, which has also got made compatible with Mario Kart 8. So Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, you can actually use the Labo motorbike, Labo kit for Toy-Con, as they're called. You can actually use that to control Mario Kart 8, which is really kind of cool. I think Labo is a lot more surprising than people think. Fair enough, the games aren't the deepest they could be. They could do a lot more with the games, I think. But also, the most recent version of Labo was actually the VR one. And it is, I'm going to class it as peripheral because I'm not classing PSVR as peripheral because I think that's more hardware. The reason I think it's more hardware is because it's like a kind of, it costs the same as a console, basically. It's more immersive, whereas the Nintendo Labo VR, you actually put the Switch into the cardboard. So, like, it's kind of like a housing for the Switch while you're using the VR stuff. It's more kind of like you connect it up to the big gun and stuff like that. So you go out blasting people with the gun while you got the Switch in it. So, I think the VR Labo kit actually works pretty well. I'm really not a fan of how you don't really have a way of fixing your head. You have to hold it up to you, which is kind of not ideal, I don't think. So I don't know, they could have put a head strap in that goes around your head, but Labo VR and like Labo in general, I think is quite ingenious. It is like a quite scientific as well. Like the games do have a mode that talks you through all the science behind it. I know a lot of schools did do it as well, so it works with like how the rubber bands work to react with each other and how kind of a lot of things you turn and how they react to each other. So it's quite good, especially if you've got kids, it's quite good for like a learning experience putting it all together. It's just fun to build. A bit of a pain to store sometimes because other bits are fairly large, but yeah, it's a lot of fun. Then the last peripheral I'm going to talk about is one that came out last year, actually, and it's, again, Nintendo Switch related. It's the Ring Fit Adventure. So you got the controllers for Ring Fit Adventure. This is Nintendo heading back to the fitness genre. And to stay with the Switch branding, the ring's called a Ring-Con. And basically you connect your Joy-Con to the top of the ring. It picks up a lot of sensors and it's actually quite a clever bit of kit. You can control how much resistance you get from the ring, stuff like that. You also have a strap that goes around your leg, so like when you're running on the spot, you can kind of it can track you, stuff like that. I think the Ring-Con is quite versatile in terms of Ring Fit Adventure, the fact that you can actually play through an adventure game with it is really kind of unique. So Nintendo, there's Nintendo thinking outside the box, really. It was a lot of fun. I think the thing that was great is you don't have to play through the story mode. You can just do like exercises and like little kind of challenges and things like that. And I just remember one morning before we opened the stand at EGX, a lot of people were having to go at one of the like chest press things. We had to squeeze the ring together as quickly as you can. I repeatedly squeeze it in and out. Let's do it as quickly as you can and get as many presses as you can. It's bloody difficult. I think it was like 20 or 30 seconds, but it left me out of breath. But yeah, I think the fact that the challenge just leaves you out of breath is really kind of cool. It was a lot of fun. Admit it, I have got it, but I haven't really booted up yet, which is something I do regret a bit because I do want to get stuck into it. But what with work and all the other games I want to try and play through, I think it was kind of taking up a bit too much of my time. So now that I've cleared Pokemon, I probably will move on to Ring Fit. So I'll probably do that over the weekend, actually. So hopefully get a bit of a go on that. That pretty much covers my talk through different peripherals and like things that I've found quite unique. I mainly focus on stuff I know and stuff that I've used. So if there's any peripherals that you think I should have mentioned, apologise, but these are kind of like ones that stood out to me. It's quite unique or quite clever. Or and things like that. So yeah. But yeah, thanks for listening to that bit. Going to start wrapping up because I do realise it's getting quite a long episode. Things I've been playing recently. I've not played a great deal. Just been doing some post-game stuff in Pokemon, trying to get some more Pokemon. And I've been doing some Tetris 99. Also got Psycho Adventure 2 running on my Xbox One. So I've been replaying Psycho Adventure 2, which is really cool. Still think it's a great game. But that's pretty much what I've been playing this last couple of weeks. Hopefully going to get Ring Fit Boosted up in between now and the next episode. So hopefully I'll be able to give you some thoughts on that. Make sure you listen out for Matt and Alex with the Game Junkies podcast. We'd have to say they do apologise for not being able to get an episode out last weekend. I think they did kind of... They just couldn't get a time together where they could actually record, unfortunately. They did have like one thing and then something came up and they weren't able to. They will be back next week. There's always fun listens a lot of the time. So hopefully it'll be a good show for you next week. As I say, if you want to find me on Twitter, please find me at Chris37 on Twitter. Well, I have got my YouTube, Chris Reacts. But I know from trying to search it, there is a lot of Chris Reacts. So I am actually considering maybe changing my name on YouTube. So if you've got any suggestions or anything you think might work, please feel free to comment or tweet me or kind of just let me know if you think of anything that I think might be a better name for my YouTube channel. Like I said, I might look at changing the name of that because it is kind of a bit hard to find, I think. Unless you go for my Twitter, it is a bit difficult to try and find my YouTube, I think. But let me know what you think, what your thoughts are. And yeah, until next time, speak to you soon. Thanks, guys.
Is a Matt Attack production for the Visionaries Wrestling Network.